Welcome into another edition of the Dayton and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. He is Dan. And Dan, this is the 54th podcast, which would mean two things. One, it's the Tom Compton podcast. And two, there's only one more of these podcasts where we have to come up with a stupid sports icon name for it.
That's right. Also, I feel like we should kind of make this the first episode of season three of this podcast. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A TV show.
It does.
And this
feel
is
that
sort
way.
Of, and this is our, and because this is our season premiere, a lot of times shows will have something crazy happen in the first episode of the season. And tonight we've got head coach of the Musketeers, Chris Mack, to talk about the Brazil trip, to talk about the sessions of practice with all the newcomers. A lot of exciting things going on in the Xavier basketball program. So it should be a great show. Season three, episode one.
Big time podcast. We're going to start season three off right with Coach Mack, like you said. And Dan, it really all starts with this Brazil trip. It was kind of, I think for fans and even someone like me who does what I do, it was so nice to have these 10 practices and then these scrimmages to be able to talk about just something during the offseason. I mean, it really kind of broke up the offseason nice. I know you went over and watched practice with me during that week, during those 10 practices that they are allowed to have. And I thought it was, you know, it was just a welcome change from the normal drags of the offseason.
Yeah, and I think when you look at this season, this really is going to be a season of transition for the Xavier program. And I know it feels like we say that every year, but I think this year especially, because of all the newcomers, you've got six freshmen on the team this year. You've got Remy Abel, who's going to be a big part of the team that's going to be playing in his first game for Xavier when they start up. So seven of the 13 scholarship spots have been turned over. I mean, there's a lot of change. And, you know, some people on the message board were asking why it'd been a while since our last podcast. It's been kind of a crazy summer. You know, Rick, you're doing a lot of stuff with the Enquirer. I had sort of a career change, all that stuff. And when you go through change, you know, it can be scary or it can be exciting. And a lot of times it's both. And the overwhelming impression that I got from fans this summer about Xavier, that I got watching the coaching staff in practice, watching these new guys interacting with their teammates, is that a lot of people are real excited about the changes that have happened to Xavier's program since the end of last season. And even though, yeah, you lose Samaje, you lose Justin Martin, you lose Isaiah Fillmore, proven performers as they were, I think there's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement about what the newcomers are going to bring to the table and how they're going to add to the base that's already in place for this Xavier team.
Yeah, and I'm going to be interested because it's always weird when you have one of these events like they had in Brazil where the only thing we really get is the box score. Granted, our guy Cliff Jenkins was there to capture some video, which was great to see that at least. But it's tough trying to judge these things from the box score, because just talking to some of, you know, sources inside the program and everything since they've been back, some of the stats sounded like they were misleading a bit, especially when you're talking about like the turnovers for certain guys. I think it was a different brand of basketball. I think the officiating was certainly suspect while they were there. I'm very interested to talk to Coach Mack and see sort of what the experience was like as far as basketball went, and get his take on how certain guys did, because we can look at the box scores and the numbers, and one thing that's certainly clear, Jalen Reynolds has continued his phenomenal summer. He was by far the most consistent player while they were on that trip. Other than that, I think there's a lot of question marks and things I'd like to get answered by Coach Mack as far as what he saw while he was watching his team play.
Sure. And just for those of you that maybe haven't followed this on a day-to-day basis, you know, it being the dog days of summer, because they were going on this for this this road trip to Brazil, was able to have 10 practice sessions prior to the trip, which they took over a 2-week period in late July. And then they were in Brazil, I think, for about 8 or 9 days. And during that period, they played 4 games under international rules. They played 2 games against Club Flamengo in Rio de Janeiro. They played 2 other games against Macaé and Tijuca. I don't know how that's pronounced.
I'm glad you're pronouncing them.
Those are both, and while Flamengo is one of the bigger clubs in Brazil, some people may know them from soccer. They're one of the big soccer teams there. I think Xavier was playing their under-23 team in those games. Flamengo is one of the, is in the top division of Brazilian basketball. The other two teams they played, Macaé and Tijuca, are lower division teams. NX really dispatched. They won all four games real comfortably, probably unsurprisingly, given the size and the talent mismatch. But obviously, you know, we got to see a few minutes of highlights from the games. We got to see the box scores. But, you know, it's sort of shrouded in mystery. It's like those closed door scrimmages that they've played the last couple of years.
Right.
And another thing about this is that the fans have gotten to see a lot less of the Xavier players during the summer than they have in previous years, because most of the guys didn't participate much, if at all, in the City Gear League.
That's true.
Usually in a given season, you know, pretty much everybody that had an interest would trek over to Woodrow or to wherever the summer league games were being played to get a look at the freshmen that were coming in. But for a lot of people, they may not have had an opportunity to see, especially a guy like a Sean O'Mara or a Larry Austin, guys that may not have had as much publicity coming in, might not be as much video or scouting on them on the internet as you know, maybe the higher profile guys like Trayvon or Edmund Sumner.
All right. Well, this seems like as good a time as any. So without further ado, we will welcome in the head coach of the Xavier Musketeers, Chris Mack. Coach, we really appreciate you joining us here on the podcast.
I appreciate you guys having me.
Hey, Coach, a lot of exciting stuff around the program this summer that we're going to get to, but I want to start by getting your take on the most important event that took place this summer, which was, of course, the intra-squad softball game. And just sort of wanted to hear how that came together and who you thought was the most impressive performer in that game, besides yourself, of course.
Well, you know, I got to give credit to Gary Waters at Cleveland State. You know, I had a chance to spend a little time with him over the summer. And he mentioned that his team, you know, did something to that effect every year. And I think we dressed it up a little bit, maybe more than those guys do up there. You know, we got uniforms. You know, we had a draft. I thought it was just a really, really good team bonding type exercise. You know, I'll tell you what, next year's draft, you're going to see some guys that were drafted high this year drop like rocks next year with the when the draft comes around. I think talents and not so much talents were on display in that softball game. Jalen Reynolds, I got to give it to him. He struck out twice, which is really hard to do in softball. But he came through in the clutch. He got the MVP by hitting a game-winning RBI. So it was fun. It was a great time.
Coach, obviously the Brazil trip, what we wanted to talk to you about. You talked when Shannon and I got the chance to talk to you at practice beforehand about how you really looked forward to this as a bonding experience for your guys. How did it work out in that sense? And what was sort of the coolest part of the trip for you?
Well, we'll see. You know, as time goes on, you know, we'll be able to reflect back. I think it was a great starting point for this year's team. You know, anytime you take over, you know, you take over a season with six freshmen, one transfer, so seven newcomers in total, you know, you want to really get the ball rolling quickly, and we wanted to get started quickly. And so that's what we did. You know, that's what we had in mind. You know, the foreign trip allows you to have 10 extra practices. They may not be what you would think of in January or February in terms of, you know, unbelievably getting after it for a longer period of time. But we practiced hard. We implemented some things. I think we taught our young guys, you know, how we practice, how we want to defend, you know, what we're going to run offensively. Of course, you know, you only have 10 days, so we don't put everything in. But I thought it was a really good start in that respect. And hopefully it'll give us a little bit of a head start as we head here into the fall, you know, with some things that, you know, are going to take a little bit of time. But, you know, from a basketball perspective, we got out of it exactly what we wanted to get out of it. We learned a lot about our team, about players, about combinations. And then, you know, the cultural experience, which I'm not going to, you know, dismiss or, you know, put that on the back burner. It was unbelievable, you know, whether it was, you know, having a class for our guys, 3 hours credit, where they learned about international trade, international business, and then also the culture of Brazil. And, you know, we also did a clinic at a local favela, which is probably one of the poorest sections of the world, poorest type slums of the world. But our guys, you know, really enjoyed their time in Brazil, and it was eye-opening.
Coach, talking about the actual games down there, I know you played Flamengo a couple of times, a couple of lower division teams, all comfortable wins. What can you tell us a little bit? I mean, obviously we saw the box scores. What was the style of play like? Can you give us a little bit of a flavor of the level of opposition and the style of play that you saw during those four games?
Yeah, well, we played 22 and under teams in all four of the matches. You know, I'd say with a 24-second shot clock and a lot of physical play on the perimeter, whether it's, you know, your point guard bringing the ball up, you know, really getting literally pushed as he's crossing over half court, didn't really allow you to get deep into, you know, shot clock situations or really, you know, being able to change sides of the floor as often as you do in the college game. We probably couldn't go inside to Jalen and Matt, who only played a couple games as it is. So it was a little different in that regard because, you know, generally we're an inside-out team and we're in the half court. Just made it a little bit more difficult with, number one, the shot clock, and number two, you know, having the ability on the defensive end to really push your way around the perimeter. But, again, it was a learning experience for our guys. I thought they did a great job.
Coach, D. Davis was out, didn't play for you guys there. Who saw minutes at the point and sort of assessed the play you got out of that position?
Well, we played three guys primarily at the point, probably pretty much evenly when you break down the minutes. And that would be Brandon Randolph, you know, returning sophomore from a year ago. And then our two freshmen, Edmund Sumner, who plays a little bit of a, you know, combo type position and the tallest point guard that we have on the roster. And then Larry Austin, who's about 6'2", freshman, originally committed to Tennessee. Those were the three guys that handled the point guard position for us. Thought they did a great job. You know, the turnovers were high, but again, a large part of that is just because of the style of play that was allowed playing overseas.
Coach, at the two, you've got an experienced player in Remy Abel, Indiana transfer, a couple other guys probably who will be in the mix battling out for minutes. What'd you see out of that position? And can you tell us a little bit about what you think Remy brings to the table?
Well, I think not only Remy, but I think we have a lot more options on the perimeter that shoot the ball better than we did a year ago. You know, Remy is very good in transition. He's very, very fast. I mean, he gets up and down the court as well as anybody on our team. He's an excellent finisher. He's got to learn to play through contact in the half court a little bit better. You know, I think he's a streaky shooter. I wouldn't call him, you know, a knockdown Brad Redford type guy. But he got hot in the last couple games, and, you know, I think he's a guy that's always going to bring it on the defensive end, and that's going to allow him to play good minutes for us. You know, I thought Miles Davis did a really good job for us. You know, I think what you can't appreciate about Miles, unless you coach him, is he's such a leader. You know, he's a guy that really cares about how his team does. You know, he didn't shoot the ball from three as well as I thought he would, but he did do a really good job of changing pace. You know, using floaters, being able to finish, you know, inside the 3-point line. But and then Brandon and Edmund played a little bit of both, you know, the one and the two. And so those guys got looks there as well. We just have a few more options than we did a year ago on the perimeter.
Coach, it looked like both Trayvon and JP had their moments on the wing and kind of split some time there. Did you play them all together at all? And how did you think they played?
We did. And, you know, Rick is almost a little bit like a say soccer substitution pattern, you know. So until we went back and watched over the four games on film, you know, we weren't really concerned about making sure that, you know, this guy's on the floor with that guy. But I will tell you that those two played together because each of them play multiple positions. Trayvon will play the three and the four for us when we go four quick. JP will play both the two and the three for us, and it just allows us to have a little bit more flexibility. So there's certainly times where both of those guys were on the court together. Now, JP got hurt in the third game. You know, we held him out of the fourth game, just precautionary to sort of hit his head on the ground in a loose ball situation. He's obviously fine, but, you know, his time was sort of, you know, diminished simply because of getting hurt on the game.
Coach, judging from the box scores and certainly the eye test at practice, the most impressive player so far seems to be Jalen Reynolds. I was particularly impressed with the progression he's had in terms of his jump shooting. Do you think things are starting to click for Jalen and we're going to see more consistently the effort we saw in some of the games down the stretch last year, this year?
if the game slows down for Jalen, you know, on the defensive end, and he's not saddled with foul trouble, man, he'll be as good as any big in our conference. And, you know, however you want to project that, whether it's as an offensive rebounder, as a post threat, as a guy that can step up and hit the 15, 17 footer, you know, Jalen, you know, you don't put him in a box in terms of what he's able to do. He's able to do a lot. But, you know, nobody's above foul trouble last time I checked. So he's got to hold that in check. He tends to be aggressive. He's got to be able to be smarter. I think the game will slow down for him. He had a monster, four games for us in Brazil. And, you know, we feel like he can be one of the best, you know, power forward centers in our conference.
Without Matt playing down there, Coach James Farr and Sean O'Mara got to see a lot of action. How did those two guys look, especially with, you know, no one having the chance to see O'Mara yet?
Did a great job. You know, James is usually one of our high volume rebounders. You know, he's got to be that for us. You know, he's got to know that, you know, whether his shot is falling or not, you know, we don't want him to identify himself as a pick and pop type player. If he's got an open jump shot, we certainly want him taking it. But James, he has to really carve out a role of being physical around the basket and rebound the ball at both ends. And I think, you know, as you saw his sophomore year sort of unwind a year ago, that's who he was in the beginning part of the year. I think he lost a little confidence as the year's gone on. But, you know, when you kind of get into your junior year, I think, you know, you really start learning about yourself and what you can bring to the table. He did a great job. And then I think Sean O'Mara was probably one of the most surprising freshmen, you know, not because we felt like, you know, Sean was less of a player, but, you know, he's got a lot of front court experience around him. You know, he was probably, in fairness, the least heralded player coming in the recruiting class that everybody's talked so much about. And he's relentless. You know, Sean may not get style points at times, but he craves physicality. He has a nose for the ball. He's relentless in his pursuit of it. And I know his teammates love him. You can come down the floor 10 times in a row, not throw him the ball, and he won't say boo. And it's that workmanlike attitude that I think his teammates really appreciate.
Coach, from a big picture view, you know, you think about maybe the team you had two or three years ago, Tu Holloway's senior year. That was an extremely veteran team, four senior starters that year. And this team is kind of on the, although you do have some veteran leadership and some guys that have been around a while, it's a much younger team. How does your job and how does your sort of mindset as a coach change in dealing with a team that has a relatively small amount of experience versus a veteran club?
Well, I'd love to tell you that it's my job to be more patient, but I don't have a lot of patience. I want to win. And, you know, our guys, when they roll out, we play, you know, Georgetown or we play Northern Arizona in our first game, people aren't going to, you know, see Xavier on the front and freshman on the back. And, you know, whether, you know, all six of them play, whether one of them plays, I don't think anybody in the stands is going to care. They're only going to care about the name on the front of the jersey, as it should be. So, again, we're probably, in terms of our coaching, probably going to have to repeat some things over and over. We're going to have to watch more film. But I'm not going to, and we're not going to, lessen our expectations because the guys are 18 years old. You know, they wanted to play high major college basketball. They wanted to come to Xavier and win the Big East, and that's what we're aiming to do regardless of what the ages are on our roster.
Coach, you've been great with your time. Before you get out of here, school just started on Monday. What's the schedule like from now until when practice starts in late September this year?
Well, you know, we try to push back a little bit, conditioning and some of our team workout type things. You know, we felt like Brazil really gave us a head start to the season. The last thing I want to do, especially as you guys have talked about with a younger team, is make the season feel like it's 10 months long. So we'll run our annual mile on September 12th, which I believe is a Friday. That'll sort of begin our conditioning phase, and, you know, we'll start everything, you know, really full speed September 15th. Now, in terms of official practice, I think the first official weekend is centered around October 3rd, 4th. We'll let the weekend come and go, and we'll start practice on that Monday, much like we did a year ago. And again, I think the Brazil trip did a lot for this team, and we're anxious to get going, but we're also going to be smart about it.
Hey, Coach, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us tonight.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, talk to you later. All right, good stuff there from Coach Mack. It's always good to get his perspective. We were talking about before we interviewed him there how it's you don't really know when you read the box scores. I think that's what you heard from him with the pushing, the shoving, the officiating that was going on in Brazil. Some of those, you know, people were all worried about Edmund Sumner's turnovers. To be honest with you, no one I've talked to seemed concerned at all about it. It sounded like those were really inflated by sort of the style of play and the way the game was being called. So I thought that was kind of, you know, he kind of hit on that. And then some of his takes on the individual players was great stuff as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to hear the coach's take after having this unique opportunity to get 20 hours of instruction or whatever it ended up being with the players in the middle of the summer, especially with such a huge recruiting class coming in. Rick, I know you went to multiple practice sessions. I was at one. We kind of wanted to run down what our thoughts were and how they might dovetail with what Coach Mack just said. Probably before we want to get into our impressions of individual players, I wanted to throw out a couple things just about the practice itself for those who maybe have never had the opportunity to see a Xavier practice. This was the first time I did. And the thing that I noticed most was that this was a coaching staff that was definitely in very much a teaching mode. There was interspersed along with implementation of things like secondary break and half court offense were some things that I would call just sort of advanced fundamentals. We saw Mike Pegues working with the big men about the proper way to throw a crisp overhead outlet pass. We saw Chris Mack at the other end, Travis Steele working with the perimeter guys to really work on their closeouts to close guys off the baseline from the perimeter in both corners. So it was definitely the staff was dividing their time between somewhat advanced, 4-on-0, 5-on-0, relatively sophisticated offensive sets with things that were basically, like I said, advanced fundamentals, things that they wanted to get their guys in good habits this early in the season. So it was cool to see the dichotomy that was there for the coaching staff. The other thing is that this team just has a lot of bodies and a lot of talent, and they compete real hard in practice because there are so many guys that are really fighting for playing time on the practice floor. And besides that, you've got in the two big men, the two primary big men, Jalen Reynolds and Matt Stainbrook, you've got two guys who are extremely competitive, extremely physical, and love beating each other up at practice. So it's a very high energy practice environment, I thought.
Yeah, and it was funny because Coach Mack mentioned that how it wasn't, you know, it's not quite what you would see in December or whatever and really get after it. But at the same time, I thought really the intensity was pretty great for these summer practices because I expected them to be a lot slower paced and more laid back with all the young guys and the coaches not being in full-blown freak-out mode like they will be when practice really starts in the end of September and into October there, like Coach Mack talked about. But I thought the biggest difference was the staff was patient. You know, he said, I'm not patient, I want to win now. But I thought the staff was just, you know, not as quick to start yelling at guys because they know the young guys don't know what they're doing yet. So I thought that was the biggest thing was they were in teaching mode. I also thought when you looked at the coaching staff, obviously the staff has been together for a little bit now. You're finally seeing some continuity. And I think these guys, not this was anything new. They did the same thing last year, but I do think they have a little more confidence and feel a little bit more sure of themselves and cohesive as a staff. I really like watching both Mike Pegues and Rick Carter coach. Mike Pegues is, as a big man's coach, he's as good as I've seen. And part of it is because he's a guy who scored a million points at Delaware and he's 6'7 and can go in and bang with the guys during drills, which that lends to a lot of credibility. And then on the other side of the court, you've got Rick Carter who is, he's got a big booming voice and he's got lots of funny ways of saying things and is constantly stopping play to teach. The coaching staff as a whole is very focused on teaching and interrupting play and making guys do things perfectly. And I think you saw a lot of that in these first 10 scrimmages where all these coaches, it's not Coach Mack coaching or maybe Coach Mack and Coach Steele chipping in on things on offense. It's all four coaches are really getting after it during practice and taking guys aside and teaching.
All right. Talking about specifics from the practices, the practice sessions, I want to start by talking about Mackenday London. in a little bit, because this is a guy that to me is maybe the most intriguing prospect on the entire roster in some ways. I mean, we know that Jalen Reynolds has an unbelievable ceiling and he's already starting to fulfill part of that potential. But Mackendy London is a guy that you look at and I mean, there's no telling what this guy could be. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen from Mackendy so far in practice and what you think maybe the plan is for him going forward? Because certainly physically, he's not quite ready probably physically to play at a Big East level, but certainly the raw materials are unbelievable.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. We don't know what Mackendy London is going to be. We're like Jalen, we're already seeing it, right? We know his potential is through the roof, but we know what he is. We know what he can do. We know what type of player he's going to be. Mackendy, it's just a piece of magnificent, talented clay to be molded still. We don't really, he's like 6'10". And super skilled. We don't really know exactly what he is. You guys know how much I hate player comparisons, but he reminds me a little bit of Shaq Thomas from UC. I mean, he's obviously about 3 inches taller, 4 inches taller, but that same just so much talent and a lot of skill and can really do some things offensively, but hasn't really figured out his game yet. Doesn't have the strength to compete at the high Division I level. I think more than likely he's going to end up getting redshirted, but at the same time, he's going to have every opportunity to go in here and prove, you know, if he can earn minutes now, great. I just don't see, looking at this front court and seeing where he doesn't even really know exactly what position he is right now, that he's probably not going to play a lot this year. And this ceiling really is so high that if you redshirt him and just give him, if nothing else, he gets this full year to worry about getting stronger and adding mass instead of just maintaining and staying in shape for the season, I think it'll be a beneficial thing for him. So that is my guess as to what happens. But Dan, when you talk about what he sort of showed in those practices, I think you posted this on the board and said it best, was that, you know, there it's at one end, he'll make a tip dunk or he'll go between the legs and hit a fadeaway three or something. And you're like, wow. I mean, this kid is incredibly talented. It might be the most talented kid in the gym. And then the next possession, he's at the other end getting tossed on his can by Kevin Coker in a box out drill. You know, I mean, you sort of don't know what to expect from him. He's very up and down right now. And I think that's sort of the story with Mackendy.
Yeah, I mean, but certainly the upside is incredible. And Rick, you actually made you made this comment, which I thought was pretty astute. We were eating lunch after practice one day, and you said, "I look at that guy, and he's so close, but he's at the same time he's so far away." And that really is what you have to say. He's very enigmatic at this early stage in his career. But man, if you could definitely see a situation where that kid gets a year to just sort of work on his game, where he adds 20, 25 pounds of muscle to his frame without any loss of athleticism, and could be really an exciting talent for Xavier next year. Because frankly, if Jalen Reynolds has the kind of season that he could have this upcoming season, they may need a replacement for Jalen Reynolds next year.
It's early to start saying that, but you're not wrong. That's realistic.
I'm excited to see how his career develops, but I definitely do think he's probably a guy that would benefit from a red shirt. Rick, one thing that you have talked about, and I think is one of the most interesting positional battles out there, is for the backup guard minutes at both the one and the two. Of the freshmen, the one that was the most impressive to me in terms of having a little bit different game than what I expected at practice was Larry Austin. And that was true for a couple reasons. First of all, he has the college ready physique. He's got broad shoulders, strong base. He's not a guy that's going to get brushed off easily. Like with an Edmund Sumner, who's 6'7", but is real thin. You could see him getting muscled around by some of the bigger guards in the Big East. Larry Austin, you don't really have that worry too much. And he's also a real vocal guy on the court. So you can tell he's a coach's son. I mean, he definitely gets what the coaches are saying. He's a quick learner. And so I was pretty impressed with what we saw from him. And his shot looks a lot better than what we were told, maybe what he had going in high school or in AAU ball. So he may be working his way into the rotation.
Well, I think that was one of my biggest takeaways from those first 10 practices, and I think you'll back me up on this. You walk into the practice, and if no one told you who anyone was, and for instance, there were several high school coaches there who come to maybe get some drills or just learn some things by watching Chris and his staff, didn't know the roster. They didn't know who the guys were. And multiple coaches made comments to me about Larry Austin and couldn't believe when I told him he was a true freshman and not a senior, because he just doesn't look, he doesn't practice anything like I've ever seen a freshman practice, especially when you're talking about a point guard position where the coaches are constantly ragging on you to not only remember all the calls and everything that they're doing, but know what everyone else is doing, be vocal, talk a lot, get guys in the right places. And the most interesting thing about when they're running the five on O's or just running through the offense in a half court set or whatever it was, Larry Austin's group, whatever group he was running with, his five always played with the most energy because he had the most energy. He brought that out of those guys. He was constantly, he never shuts up. I mean, he's loud. He's very vocal. He plays fast. I look at him and he's a true point guard. Right now, Mac talked about it. Brandon Randolph played there some, and Edmund Sumner played there some. Neither one of them looked like true point guards right now. I think Edmund Sumner has all the upside in the world if he wants to play or they want to play him at the point going forward. But right now, as he's still learning things, he's an introverted kid. He doesn't speak out. He wasn't talking much. I mean, it was completely different compared to the way Larry Austin ran the show. And he just looked like a point guard. So the way I looked at those things is it's going to be really difficult for him not to pass some of these other guys up when you're talking about Miles and Brandon, because they don't necessarily have a position. They're kind of undersized combo guards that really aren't ones. And Larry is a true one. So if I go for right now, who is the backup to D. Davis? It's probably Larry Austin. I mean, it might be Brandon Randolph because he has the experience for right now. But I'm telling you, a month into the season, it's going to be really hard, I think, for it not to be Larry Austin as the backup point guard.
Well, and the other thing Austin has going for him is that he's a really good athlete and a good defensive player.
Huge.
And that's something that can't be said for either Randolph or Davis, you know, as good as they can be in other aspects of the game. And Coach Mack definitely values defense at those perimeter spots. And I think it frustrated him mightily when he didn't have, you know, players with sufficient size or athleticism to guard outside. But you think of last year when Samaje and Dee were playing good defense in tandem, Xavier became a very difficult team to score against because they could extend the defense way outside. And if they were coming up against, you know, a player like Kellen Dunham, who's not the world's greatest athlete, but can be an incredible scorer if he can shake free, they were able to really put the shackles on him because they were able to extend the defense pretty far up the court. So I think Larry Austin's got a lot. He's going to get a good chance to get in the rotation this year, which I don't think was something a lot of us anticipated when he committed. Talking about the 2-3 position, I mean, there's just so many guys that are in the mix there. Trayvon, JP McCura, Remy Abel. You've got, as you said, Miles Davis will get some time at the two. And I think Miles, you know, Coach Mack talked about it. One of the things about Miles that I continue to be so impressed by is he's a guy that if you give him a dribble and he can get into the lane, he's got just incredible body control for a guard and is able to get his shot in the lane and in and around the lane, no matter what situation he's in. It's not something we saw him do a lot last year. And I think a lot of it probably had to do with the fact that he just was in such an abysmal slump from three that he didn't have a great deal of confidence.
I think his knee too. I really do. You know, people said that and I never really thought much about it last year, but then when he came back this summer and I was talking to him a little bit more, I mean, he made it seem like the knee did bother him more than he ever let on. And I mean, heck, he was getting 15 minutes a game. He wasn't going to tell anybody and give those minutes up as a freshman. But I do think that really did factor into his sort of, I mean, not that he has explosiveness when driving, but he kind of like a bowling ball. If you give him a step or two and he can get, you give him a opportunity to get that momentum going forward, he's going to lean into you and kind of get where he wants to go. And get that mid-range floater or bank kind of off. And yeah, I think Miles could have a better year. I think he brings, you know, Mac talked about his leadership. He is a guy who definitely cares. You can't deny that. When he's there at practice, he works his butt off and he's engaged and he wants to be a good teammate and a leader. So I think, you know, this is going to be so interesting to watch how these minutes play out at the guard spots. And you were talking about the wing, adding JP and Trayvon. I think think we will see, you know, from time to time, you might see Miles slide in and play the three like we saw last year if they go small. And I definitely think the biggest thing about JP and Trayvon is both of these guys are good. My biggest takeaway from Trayvon in those 10 practices is he's not a guy who wows you in practice, which I already knew, but he did impress me with how big he is. Like, I knew he was a thick wing, but when I saw him next to all the, you know, Jalen and James and those guys, he's really thick. Even for the Division I high major college basketball level, he's a thick guy. I think he might end up playing more four in his career than we thought originally. And, you know, the only thing that might keep it, prevent him from that happening this year is the fact that they have such good post play with Matt and Jalen and James and Sean already, that he might not get as many minutes there. But I think the staff is going to come down to this point where they're going to feel the need to get both Trayvon and JP on the court at the same time.
Well, and I think one of the things that I really like about this roster as you head into the season is there is more positional flexibility than X has had in a while. I mean, last year you would see on occasion them shift Justin Martin down to a four if Fillmore was in foul trouble in the first half, or if Stainbrook got in foul trouble and they need to go a little bit smaller. I feel like they're going to have the facility to do that a lot more this year. It's this season, if Jalen Reynolds gets two fouls before the first TV timeout, it's not going to be one of those things where you're just like, well, triage for the rest of the half. It doesn't have to be that way for this team, because like you say, they can go a little bit smaller. They can put Trayvon Blewett at the four. They can put JP at the three. They can have Remy out there, or they can move around guys in the backcourt. And I just think they have so many moving pieces this year that they're going to have a little bit more flexibility when game situations arise. And it's not going to be that sort of next man up type situation, like, oh, who's the backup for? He's got to go in and cover that position for the next 5 minutes. I don't think it has to be that way this year. But I wanted to talk about the big man, because the practice that we were at, we happened to be sitting in front of the basket where the bigs were practicing. And Sean O'Mara was the guy that popped out to me. And Coach Mack mentioned it a little bit, but I just wanted to expand a little bit and say, a lot of times with freshman big men, you get one of two problems. One is that they're big guys that can't control their weight, and so they're out of shape and their conditioning isn't there. And I think you could probably point to Jason Love when he arrived at Xavier, or Kenny Freeze maybe, sure, when he arrived at Xavier as an example. Matt Stainbrook when he started Western Michigan, certainly. And those guys, they may be super coordinated, but they're just carrying too much weight and they can't be 20, 25 minute guys from the outset just because they're not in good enough shape. Or you get the guy that's had the huge growth spurt and hasn't figured out his athleticism yet, that's still a little bit uncoordinated and gangly. I think James Farr, his freshman year, probably would be an example. Jeff Robinson, early in his career, some might say his whole career, was a guy that never seemed to really get comfortable with his capabilities. O'Mara is neither of those. This is a guy that's 6'8". He's a below the rim player. There's no question about that. But this is a guy who's in good shape, who's strong. He's an offensive lineman during the football season in high school. So obviously he's seen the inside of a weight shed. He's a strong guy. He's got good footwork. He's not on skates. I looked at him and I was like, yeah, this is not a guy I would feel uncomfortable with getting, you know, 10 minutes a game this year if it came to it. And in selected games, maybe playing maybe getting 10, 15 minutes, because the guy is not going to kill you. He's not a guy that's so ungainly that you just don't know what he's going to do out there. He looks like a guy who can come in, rebound his position, clean up at the basket if he has to. Almost kind of, I don't want to say that this is his ceiling, but almost like an Andrew Taylor was for Xavier his junior and senior years, where you had just a solid guy off the bench who could come in and rebound the basketball and not kill you.
Well, and Sean's so much bigger.
Yeah.
You know, so defensively really helps you out there and on the glass too. But no, I think you're hitting right on the nail on the head with the big guy talk. I think the biggest thing for me is I came into this year and I thought James Farr was going to have a pretty good year. Watching those practices, I felt even, you know, watching all of summer league and those practices and open gyms, I felt even more strongly that James Farr is going to have a really good year. But at the same time, the more I watch Sean O'Mara, the more I'm thinking James Farr better have a really good preseason and start the season off well. or Sean O'Mara is going to get some of his minutes, because Sean O'Mara is hungry for minutes. He's capable of earning those minutes and probably would get minutes had it been last year, the year before, pretty much any year since Chris Mack has been coaching. He probably would have gotten minutes on any of those teams. This year is a little bit different because I think you have three guys that can play the minutes and that are going to warrant playing most of the minutes at the four and the five ahead of him. But Coach Mack mentioned his relentlessness and that he craves physicality. And those are the two things that without question stood out to me. And I'll go to one specific moment where he went up against Matt Stainbrook. He was on offense. Matt was on defense and they're working one-on-one in the post on different drills, like wall ups and things like that defensively. And he just absolutely got served. He tried to do a pump fake move on Matt, went up the other way, and Matt had just walled up completely, stopped the ball, slammed it right back into the ground. Sean fell down. I mean, it was classic freshman going up against the experienced, much stronger senior moment. And Jalen tries to step in and goes, "I got you." And he goes, no, "I'm going again," and pushes Jalen out of the way, gets right back in there, gets the ball back from the coach, goes at Matt again, powers through him twice before he actually gets his shot off, and just misses. It rims out. Matt was working him hard defensively. And I just looked at that moment and I'm like, that kid's going to be all right, just because I don't know what his ceiling is. I don't know how good he has the potential to be, but he's going to be all that he can be. I know that because he's got the right mentality for it. He's got the strength. He's got enough size. He's going to be solid, and I think it's going to be sooner rather than later.
So James Farr better come out ready to play in the preseason and to start the season, because, if he doesn't get the job done, I don't think the coaches will have too much of a problem looking towards the future and getting Sean O'Mara experience this year to get ready for life without Matt Stainbrook.
Well, and the thing is, for those big men, once you get beyond Jalen and Matt, I mean, if Trayvon Blewett is taking minutes at the four, all of a sudden the pool of available minutes when there's no foul trouble is contracting.
It really
so all
is.
Those guys are really going to be busting it in this preseason period to try and win those minutes. There's just a lot of battles that are going to go on this team to win minutes. And for once, I don't feel like there's any position where you're really looking at, well, what's the lesser of two evils at this position? Who's going to hurt us less? You get a guy like I always thought that Martin was unfairly maligned by some corners of the fan base. But the fact is, the guy's defensive effort was variable and he wasn't a consistent 3-point shooter. So there were games where he just gave you nothing and it was a roll of the dice what you were going to get at the three on that day. I'm not sure that I see any particular position where I'm just completely clueless about what I'm going to get with this team. So I think there's a lot of things that are very positive to take from this summer trip. Rick, we want to talk very quickly we want to move on to the 2015 recruiting class. This is an interesting one. You think Xavier is kind of zeroing in on their main target. What can you tell us about the situation with Kipper Nichols?
Yeah, and I think they have been zeroed in, but, I wish there was more information to give. It's been kind of quiet on the recruiting front, but that's just the way it is when you have such a big recruiting class in 2014 and really just a class that the staff doesn't like a whole lot in 2015, and really probably only one guy that they're going to take in the class, one scholarship that they're going to use. So Kipper Nichols is the guy that they want right now. There's zero question about that. They've put the full court press on him, and he's going to be visiting in September. They were going to have him in like last weekend, but a lot of the guys were still away from campus visiting home for the last time before school started this past Monday. So they're going to wait until everyone's there, can put the full court press on him. And, I'm not saying expect a commitment, but it's certainly going to be a visit that we're all I'm going to have myself in it on me the entire weekend. I can tell you that. The KJ Walton is another guy that I would kind of keep an eye on because there's still some talk going on there. I think he's still getting some interest, and there's a couple other guys that they're keeping lines of communication open with in case, a guy has a really good senior year or the coaches don't get Kipper and decide, maybe we do need another big guy when you get a month into the season and a couple of these guys aren't panning out or something like that. So there may be more movement, but as of right now, I'd really say there's sort of one guy in the 2015 recruiting hot board, and that's Kipper Nichols.
What's just to refresh the recollection of our listeners, talk a little bit about Kipper's game. He's from Lakewood St. Ed's, right? The same school that the Stainbrooks came from. Combo forward, right? And what have you seen from him, or what do you hear from him from guys who are out on the trail?
The thing is, I think he's about 6'6", maybe 6'7", with good length and athleticism and strength. And he is a combo forward. But I think the thing the staff likes about him is they feel he's a three at this point. I talked to Snow. Snow saw him play really, really well at the end of July, and said, and Snow said he had no doubt at this point that he was a three, and he was plenty skilled to do so. And Snow said he shot the ball well, handled it well, which he was impressed with and was really looking for. I've seen it in glimpses. I just haven't seen him do enough offensively. He's not a super aggressive offensive guy. But when I look at sort of the class and what they've already got behind him in 2014 and where they're sort of going, we keep talking about all the versatility and the interchangeability they have at positions. This makes sense. He's a really good defender. And what do they have right now in the way of 6'6" guys? Guys who can really score and not very good defensively when you talk about JP and Trayvon. So this makes sense. Another guy you can throw in there that can play multiple spots, that can really defend multiple positions. And I think he's got an offensive game that they're very comfortable with, and they feel he's getting better and is improving on that end. So he's a guy that I think would be a very solid get. I don't know that he wows you and he's a big-time scorer at any point in his career, but I think he's going to be very solid and can do a lot of different things for your team. He's just one of those guys who makes lots of winning plays and is tough. You know, all the intangible cliches that you want to throw in there kind of apply to him.
Well, after this season, obviously D. Davis will graduate. Matt Stainbrook will run out of eligibility. He graduated in May, but still has a year of eligibility doing a graduate year. So I actually have two scholarships open for next year, but your take is that it probably will be Kipper Nichols if they can get him, and then they'll hold that scholarship back to see if something crazy happens.
Yeah, and I mean that's not final, but I would guess. And you got to remember, they could always save one back for 2016 and just use it in that class, which they might like better. And heck, maybe we're not even talking about a guy who's currently in the 2016 class, but maybe there's someone in 2015 that they kind of would like to take one of the scholarships, but they don't feel he's ready right now. It's not the right time. Send him to prep school for a year, and then he becomes a 2016 guy that you sort of just saved the scholarship for. So I think you could see that with a guy or two in this class as well. You know, there's a couple others out there that they've offered at sort of in July that might be candidates for that.
All right, Rick. Other things around the program right now, new floor.
What'd you think? We've seen multiple pictures of it now. I imagine you have, at least. The volleyball team was playing on it the other night. We've seen some pics. What do you think?
Well, the first thing, I think there's some silliness afoot, because if you remember, this was originally a fan contest to design the floor.
Yeah.
And the choice that was made just happens to look exactly like the entry by friend of the podcast, Mario Mercurio.
So what are you saying? We need to have him on the next podcast to ask him?
I am not saying anything. I'm just saying it's interesting. That's all I'm saying.
After he posted that, I saw about 750 people send in some variation of the city design on the court with just different colors on the baseline or something. I mean, I did see several people submit that sort of same design.
Those were all from anonymous Yahoo accounts that Mario said.
Mario started. Mario has three Gmails, one AOL, a Hotmail.
He's just got tons of those free AOL CD-ROMs from like 1996. And
he installed all of them on his computer and used his dial-up modem to create fake accounts.
No, seriously, I haven't seen it live. I've seen some of the I've just seen some video on the news that was kind of from the baseline, so you don't really see what it's going to look like on TV. You know, it looks like it's relatively innocuous. I'm not a huge fan of the really out there court designs like that Oregon.
Yeah, the Oregon one's terrible.
The Oregon one, it's just too much, and you can't really even tell what's going on. But I do like some of the like Arizona's got like a cactus or something like that that's inlaid into the floor that's kind of cool. I know Ohio State has the outline of the state of Ohio around the center circle in a slightly different color wood, which looks really good on TV. So
yeah.
I think that there's some I'm not saying that I necessarily hate it. I'm not saying that I won't be in favor of it. I just need to see it in practice. But I'm typically a relatively a traditionalist. The one thing that I did like is I did notice that they changed the Big East logo on the floor. So it's all navy blue instead of red. Being red and blue, which I know that the presence of red on the Xavier floor gave a lot of people the goo last year. So that's definitely a positive. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, what's your take on it? I mean, you've seen it in person, so.
Yeah, I really like it, but I kind of like these inlay courts with the designs anyways, as long as they're not too crazy like Oregon. And a couple of people I know didn't like it because it wasn't original. There are other skylines on courts already. My thing for that is I don't care because Cincinnati's is cooler looking. Like, I really do think Cincinnati has a very cool looking skyline. I think the way it comes off on the court looks good. So the fact that I'm one, a fan of the court designs, and two, a fan of the Cincinnati skyline, it kind of works out well for me.
What was your take on the criticism that Xavier really – that the city of Cincinnati isn't – like some people, their point was, well – I mean, Xavier's not that. That's good for UC, but Xavier's not really selling the city of Cincinnati. It's more, you know, it's a Jesuit school, it's a private school, et cetera. Do you put any stock into that criticism?
I don't put stock into the criticism. I look at that and maybe see a kind of genius marketing ploy. And if you remember what you already mentioned, that one Mario Mercurio was behind this design, things start making a little more sense to me because, I mean. Do you have a problem with being known as Cincinnati's team? Don't Xavier fans kind of feel this way feel that way at this point? I mean, look at the way that they've had Matt Latos, Pac-Man Joe, they've started bringing celebrities into the game and filming and making a big deal. I think there's a concentrated effort to kind of make Xavier Cincinnati's team.
I definitely think that is and I bet you that they would say that absolutely is a strategy of theirs, that they want to make Xavier games a little bit more, give them a little bit more of that Showtime aspect. And of course, you know, one of the things that they're doing this fall is that they're bringing in the Cavs and Pacers for a preseason game. You know, I think, and with the addition of the courtside seating, it gives it a little more of that big time look on TV. So I absolutely think that's part of their strategy. I mean, I'm surprised they haven't gotten George Clooney to a game yet, but I can't imagine it'll take much longer.
Yeah.
So,
I think you can even see it with the way they treat the media. You know, I mean, just everything Xavier does, I think, is sort of they do things to set themselves up for this. And UC really hasn't over the past 5 years to 5 to 10 years. And I think Xavier's taken complete advantage of that. That if UC doesn't want to do it, why don't we?
Well, certainly one thing that you would definitely have to say is there is a huge difference in, and this is kind of inside baseball stuff and people probably don't care, but there's a huge difference in the facilities and so forth at Xavier as compared to, say, US Bank Arena for the press and for the people that are working the game. So certainly you see a pretty major difference. Rick, the last thing that I wanted to bring up to you is to talk a little bit about the Division IV, the autonomy principle that's going around, the O'Bannon case. There's a lot of crazy stuff happening in college sports right now. A lot of the traditional paradigms that the NCAA had set up over the years are being challenged and are being challenged quite successfully. And I guess my question for you is, first of all, what's your take on the changes that have occurred over this offseason? And do you think it will affect, number one, the Xavier program, but from a bigger perspective, just sort of your enjoyment of college sports or how it's going to change college sports going forward?
Well, the only thing that is really going to screw it up, I think, is when they've completely seceded and you're completely split apart between the big football schools that are only playing in their own sort of league or division versus the rest of college. That's not going to be a good situation. I don't know how that's going to work with other sports. I find it, even though it looks like it's inevitable at this point, I still find it hard to believe that they don't figure something out to make this make more sense. The most interesting thing about some of these rulings, I think we're going to be tied up in litigation for another several years before anything really happens, because what's going to happen is all of this stuff, they're basically saying, I guess, that at the elite levels, these kids should be getting paid, right? I mean, the elite levels of football, these guys do deserve money and do deserve to be treated in a way that's different from the rest of student athletes. Well, what that's going to conflict with is Title IX. So as soon as these things change and there's an uneven playing field, someone's going to sue on the basis of Title IX and they're going to win. So then the court's going to have to sort out which takes precedence there between the two rulings. And that's when we're really going to figure out what the future of college athletics is. Because right now I see a lot of issues with all these things that are starting to happen and the rules that have all and laws that have already been established with Title IX.
I think that the situation in college sports was becoming untenable because of the amount of money that was being thrown, particularly at football, coupled with what we now know about how dangerous playing football at a high level is. Right. And it's proven at this point. And so when you have the NCAA simultaneously sell, you can go to the NCAA website, type Johnny Manziel in the search bar, and it pops up a number two Texas A&M number two jersey. And then by the same token, you know, you're suspending a guy for selling his trophy, selling his Sugar Bowl ring or something like that. I think that there's just a basic idea of fairness that really offends people, that these kids are really risking serious injury and not seeing anything out of it. And I know, and look, I mean, I understand the value of a college education and everything else, and when you get to that amount of money that's being thrown around and that money is disappearing into ever more opulent and ridiculous facility palaces that 90% of students don't even use, and going to pay Nick Saban $10 million a year, I understand why people are getting a little bit infuriated with it, because there's just a level of fairness that isn't there. Now, your point about Title IX, I think, is interesting, and we'll see how that works out. I actually think for a school like – I think that there is not going to be any immediate problem associated with this for Xavier or for the other Biggie schools.
No, I agree. I think we're years away from that, maybe a decade.
These schools may get together and they're going to come up with a stipend that they're going to play, that they are going to initially pay men's basketball, you know, a full cost of attendance stipend, basically. And it probably will apply to men's basketball, men's football, obviously, and then some women's sports to make up the difference. So for a school like Xavier, I mean, honestly, it's probably a little bit of a competitive advantage in some ways, because all they have to do is provide the cost of living to the women's basketball team and they're in compliance.
Right.
And I don't think a school like Xavier is not going to build the Cintas Center. They're not going to spend 30 years in a basically in a strategic plan to increase attendance, to increase coach salary, to increase engagement by fans and boosters, and get into the Big East and get these the Madison Square Garden contract and the Fox Sports One contract and all this stuff, and then say and then cheap out at the last minute when right. it comes to matching the cost of living. And the rest of the Big East is not going to do that either. The place where this is going to be interesting, and I don't think there's going to be any immediate competitive disadvantage to Xavier recruiting against the big conference teams. What's going to be interesting to me is what happens to those conferences that are in the echelon that Xavier's just left behind. I'm talking about the Atlantic 10. I'm talking about the West Coast Conference. The Mountain West will go. They'll do full cost, but some of those conferences that are right underneath.
Are you saying Fordham's not going to pay their players?
That's what I'm saying. Yes. And so the question is, when Dayton goes to the Atlantic 10 and says, hey, we've got to be able to do this to stay competitive, and they obviously have the money in their athletic department, and the A10 has to put it to a vote as to whether to exempt them. And the rest of the, and you know, half the A10 says, no, we're not paying our players, and screw you, Dayton. That's going to be a problem. There's going to be that. So the schools that I think that are kind of at the most jeopardy are the top schools, the historically competitive schools at that next tier of conferences, if those conferences elect not to go forward. So a Gonzaga would be a perfect example. A BYU, they'd probably just go independent if they found themselves in that situation.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of things that are yet to happen, but I don't think Xavier is badly positioned given where they are and given the financial stability of the athletic department as it stands right now. But you know, we talked about it when the Northwestern unionization petition was filed. We talked about it when when the Big East broke away and we were talking about what expansion might look like. I mean, there's a lot of changes that are in the pipeline, and it could end up with college basketball being irreparably broken. And this isn't even to talk about the one and done rule and some of the other stuff that grinds people's gears.
Right.
There's a lot of issues in college basketball right now, and there's going to be movement on them over the next decade. And it could be a far different game 10 years from now than it is right now. That's not saying it necessarily be worse. It may be something that more closely approximates the ideal of what you would think of when you say college basketball, but it may be a way worse product. It's too early to say at this point.
Yeah, my thing is, I don't have the idea of like players getting paid or not doing it for the love of the game anymore doesn't bother me in the slightest. Like, that won't ruin my viewing pleasure at all. The only time I'm like the game changes for me and it's not as fun is, like we said, if they split into like a new division, their own division four or something, and all those football schools are now, you know, they have their own conference or division of athletics, and all the sports play in that, and then we don't have like March Madness as we know it anymore. Like, that would crush me. Not having the NCAA tournament with all the schools in it would be like the worst possible outcome. But outside of that, like, just players getting paid doesn't bother me in the slightest.
Yeah. That's pretty much where I am. Well, I think that'll do it for this 54th edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, the Tom Compton cast, the first episode of season 3 of this podcast. Want to thank Coach Chris Mack for joining us on the program tonight. Really appreciate his insight into the 10 sessions of practice, the Brazil trip, the softball game, and everything else we spoke about with him.
Yeah, we did. The only thing we didn't bring up was the Andy Dalton contract with Coach Mack. That was probably the most important question to ask him, and we blew it. So,
well, that gives us a hook to get him on again sometime.
That's right. All right. So for the Tom Compton 54th edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, I'm Rick. He's Dan. Thanks for listening, everyone.